eyes, which meant the paper was put to bed late Sunday night. Early Sunday morning, Kurt's father picked him up for hockey practice. He greeted Yale stiffly and whispered something to Cecily. The ex was a big man, big with both fat and muscle, in possession of a remarkably uncharming Irish accent. Yale could see the man in Kurt's upturned nose, wide mouth. He wondered if it was best, in this situation, to come across gay, as in not involved with Cecily, or straight, lest the man get deranged ideas about Yale's interest in the 11-year-old. He tried to act natural, which was probably on the gay side. He did his laundry in the building's basement, and then he took the L into the city. His feet, Cecily was right, were slowly dying in those shoes, even with socks. There was slush today on all the sidewalks, and in no time it had soaked through. It was 1 o'clock. He walked, with a numb determination he imagined assassins felt, down Belmont, through the door next to the taco place, up the flight of stairs that led to a dentist and an insurance agency, and the Out Loud offices. Dwight, who worked out front, looked up and waved. Nothing amiss. Charlie was in his office talking with Gloria. Yale walked in as he'd done 100 times and sat in the chair by the door. Gloria gave a little wave and kept talking. Didn't seem to notice that Charlie had stiffened. Yale felt like a ghost, visible only to one person. Only Charlie saw this specter at the door. Only Charlie felt the chill. Gloria said, "You want me to come back?" And Yale said, "Keep going. I'm happy to wait." As if he were dropping off Charlie's sandwich. He hadn't seen Charlie's face since he left for Door County. The last time he'd looked at Charlie, it had been with complete trust. Charlie hurried Gloria out, said they should meet after layout was done. He shut the door behind her. He said quietly, "Jesus, Yale." He looked everywhere but into Yale's eyes. Yale knew his own silence was a kind of power. He stayed in the chair, arms crossed. There were at least 5 things he planned to say, and several answers he intended to demand, but not quite yet. Charlie went back and sat in his desk chair, and for a moment it looked as if he were going to collapse sobbing. In a way, it would have been the only appropriate thing. But instead his lips thinned, his nostrils flared. He said, "I didn't know how to reach you. You could have called my office. I meant yesterday, or today. What did you want to say?" Charlie put his elbow on the desk, then his forehead in his hand. "I needed to tell you that Terence died." Yale only stopped breathing for an instant, because it wasn't true. What the hell was Charlie trying to pull? No, he didn't. Actually, he did. Was he trying to prove that Yale wouldn't know if a thing like this had happened? Yale said, "Sorry, but I was just there. I stayed there at his place on Thursday night. He's fine." Charlie's voice was suddenly patient. "That might be true. But they took him to the hospital late Friday morning. He died Friday." Yale didn't believe him. But then why did he find himself crying? His tears were hot and fat, and they rolled silently into his mouth. Charlie said, "I'm glad you were with him." Terence had looked so sick on New Year's, had seemed about to go. But not on Thursday. Not on Friday morning. He'd been on the bathroom floor, but that was normal. And Yale had left him there. Yale had kept him up talking the night before. Yale had tracked germs into his house. He felt like tearing the air around him to shreds. He couldn't think. He said, "Where's Roscoe? Who the hell is Roscoe? The cat. Nico's cat. Terence had him. That's what you're concerned about? I'm sure Fiona has it." Yale said, "I was with him at the hospital on New Year's. That's good. I'm glad. Where the fuck were you on New Year's? Yale, don't start. The thing is, the service is at 3. Today? How many days had passed? 2? This seemed even less plausible, even more of a horrid joke than the actual death. He said, wait, so he what? He called an ambulance on Friday? Or someone found him? What time? I don't know the details, Yale. How is this happening today? He was asking the wrong questions. Watching Julian's production of Hamlet, he'd been struck by Laertes' response to Ophelia's death. Oh, where? He'd said when he heard the news. But yes, look, it was right. The details were what you grabbed for. Fiona's organized it. Of course. That was part of the whole power of attorney thing, dealing with the body. Charlie said, it'll be odd if we aren't there together. Will it? I just mean, we shouldn't burden Fiona with this right now. You can sit beside me. It won't kill you. Yale had never hit anyone in his life. Not really hit. But he wanted to right then. He wanted to grab all the gay weeklies from around the country that Charlie hung on those pretentious racks behind his desk and crumple them, one by one, in his face. But Charlie looked so tired. Blue moons under his eyes. Yale said, even though he knew it was ridiculous, where did you even have this testing done? Yale, it's positive. I was exposed and it's positive. 1 + 1 = 2. I'm dead. He flung out the last word like a hand grenade. And if Charlie had broken down right then, if his face had crumpled, Yale might have softened, gone around to him, held him in his arms even as he stared out the window conflicted. But Charlie's face didn't change. Yale had come here planning to yell, and the fact that he wasn't yelling was concession enough. Charlie said, would you please just sit near me at the bloody church so we don't have to explain this to everyone? The thing was, Yale wasn't ready to explain it either. I'll need a suit. Fuck, is Teresa in the apartment? I can call and send her on an errand. Yes, please do. It's at the Unitarian place. You've got, what, 2 hours? This was the same church where they'd held services for Asher's friend Brian. A gay-friendly church right off Broadway, and thus, recently, Funeral Central. Yale said, I don't even understand. I don't get... And he stopped talking, wiped his face with his sleeve. Charlie said, I'm sorry you're so torn up about Terence. Okay, Charlie. Instead of screaming, he walked out of the office. He closed the door, really believing that Charlie would call him back, chase him down. Had this truly been their first and only conversation since Yale had called him jubilant from Wisconsin? He'd talked to Charlie so many times in his head that it didn't seem right. And how had he left without making Charlie apologize, beg forgiveness, explain? He got angrier as he walked. He felt deflated in the office, but the cold air, the sun, every step away from Charlie, filled him again with indignation. Charlie had not, for an instant, expressed concern for Yale, for his health. But then had Yale said, at least, I'm sorry you're infected? Maybe they were both terrible, prideful people. Maybe they deserved each other. He tried to imagine the kind of man who, faced with the news that his jealous lover was, in fact, making a fool of him and had blithely exposed him to a fatal disease, would say it didn't matter, would stay calm and supportive and sign up for months, years of bedside care and devastation. Who would do that? A saint, maybe. A patsy. It had taken ages for Yale to learn to stick up for himself. After those boys on the basketball team tricked him, hadn't he gamely sat with them at lunch the next day? But apparently, somewhere along the line, he'd figured it out. He knocked first to make sure Teresa was gone, and he turned the key slowly. He hated the version of himself that had stood here last, ready to share the details of his amazing trip, oblivious to the coming ambush. He hated that if the Yale from 3 days ago could see the Yale of right now, he'd misinterpret the scene, think he was coming home from lunch somewhere, a little bedraggled but happy, normal. Everything was slightly out of place. Teresa's pillbox sat on the table next to a New Yorker he hadn't seen yet. A stack of cassette tapes stood balanced on the arm of the couch, as if Charlie had been sorting them or looking up lyrics. Yale found his own mail stacked neatly by the phone. Some alumni thing. A postcard from his cousin in Boston. No utility bills, thank God, or he'd have torn them up, left the scraps on the floor. Yale usually paid the rent, but the apartment was in Charlie's name. He'd been living here when they met. Yale changed into his suit, and then he found a decent-sized box on top of the refrigerator. Charlie had bought a carton of grapefruit right after New Year's for some fundraiser, and filled it. His passport, his grandfather's watch, 2 shirts, a pair of khakis, his checkbook, and a mug of CTA tokens. He put Nico's topsiders in there, but shoved the other clothes he'd been wearing into the laundry hamper for Charlie or Teresa to deal with. He put his dress shoes into the box for later, got his snow boots from the front closet. He padded the rest of the box with socks and underwear, and draped the whole thing with a sweater. He'd have taken a suitcase, but the only big one was Charlie's. In the refrigerator were cold cuts he'd bought before his trip. They ought to be long expired, from a different decade, but they were still fresh, still fine. He made a sandwich with turkey and Munster, and stood at the counter to eat. It felt too normal. As if Charlie were down the hall, ready to step out of the shower with a towel around his waist, everything fine. He could put his hand on Charlie's chest, feel his heart through his wet, warm skin. The truth was, his body missed Charlie. Or missed Charlie's body. Just the presence of it. Not sexually, not yet. Although surely that would get worse, on nights when he lay alone and awake. The tensed muscles of Charlie's thighs. The way he bit Yale's ears. The taste of him. The impossibly slick smoothness under his foreskin. Well, here it was then. Longing, missing. The most useless kind of love. He was rinsing his plate when the door opened. Teresa said,
I thought you'd have left.
I can. I should. She put her purse on the counter and walked toward him as if she planned to hug him, but she didn't. Her face looked terrible, dry and deeply creased. Her chin, her jowls had dropped. Her eyelids were swollen. She said,
Yale, are you all right? Have you been tested yet?
It would be pointless.
You'd feel better. Charlie would feel better.
Charlie's feelings aren't my concern. She looked pained.
I don't see why you boys have to fight. You love each other.
Yale wondered if that was true. Teresa picked up his hand in her own, stroked the back of it. She said,
If you'd come home, I could take care of both of you. I've been cooking, you know. And not just soggy British food. Did I tell you I took an Italian cooking class this fall? I have a wonderful meatball recipe now. Only Charlie won't eat beef.
I'm fine, he said. I'm going to be fine.
He made a mistake. It was the first thing he said when he called. He said he'd made a mistake and he couldn't fix it.
That is true. He cannot fix it.
Yale, I'm worried if he's upset he'll get sick faster. He'll wear himself out worrying.
Yale marveled at this turn of logic. The idea that he was now the one making Charlie sick. He could sit here and explain things about AIDS that would make Teresa's head spin. Or he could say that Charlie hadn't uttered a word of apology, but what good would it do? He told her he was meeting Charlie at the funeral, and this seemed to appease her. She said, "Be gentle with him, won't you?" So that he wouldn't be seen walking down Halstead with the box. Yale turned east and took the long way around, a route that took him past the house he'd toured. He should have kept walking, but he stopped to look. A masochistic gesture. Because even if he wasn't sick, even if he got some enormous raise and could afford the house all on his own, he'd never buy a place down the street from Charlie. Even if Charlie were gone, he couldn't live so close to where they'd been happy together. Couldn't walk past their old apartment on his way to the L. But did he truly believe Charlie would ever be gone? It was still a hypothetical in his mind, like a tornado hitting the city. Did he believe, as foolishly as Julian used to, that someone was about to announce a cure? He didn't think that was it. It was all just a rock that hadn't sunk yet, that was still hitting the surface of the pond. The for sale sign was still there, the phone number glowing in the late sun, runic writing that no longer held meaning. In the window of the place next door, a cat slept. Someone played the piano. Yale dodged the people congregating in the church lobby and ducked down a back hallway to find a place for his box. He put it behind a beanbag chair in what must have been a youth group room, a place where the kids had painted the walls with daisies and frogs and Beatles lyrics. Then he straightened his suit, damped his hair down in the bathroom, found Fiona, and helped her with the flowers she was carrying. He gave her the necklace from Nora, said she mustn't ever wear it around her cousin Deborah, and Fiona held up her curls so Yale could fumble with a clasp behind her neck. "I've never done this before," he said, and Fiona, for some reason, found that hilarious. He helped straighten the chairs in the sanctuary. Yale appreciated the chairs. Less ass-numbing than pews. Less likely to dredge up negative childhood memories. By the time Charlie arrived, the front of the place had filled. Charlie was trailed by some of his staffers, Gloria, Dwight, Raphael, Ingrid. They must have changed at the office, then walked here together. They'd be walking back together, too, while Yale wandered off alone. Yale caught Charlie's eye, and a minute later Charlie was there beside him, smelling like aftershave. The minister spoke about community and friendship and the family you choose, tremendously aware of his audience, obviously practiced in this sort of thing. How many of these funerals had he personally overseen? Fiona got up and told a story about the day Nico introduced her to Terence. "He warned me that Terence had a sense of humor," she said. "And so I was terrified. I kept waiting for him to put a whoopee cushion on my chair or something. But he didn't crack a single joke. At the end of lunch, he looked at me and he said, 'You've taken care of your brother your whole life. And I—'" Her voice had run into a wall. She tried again, but no sound came out. She said, "It would have been easier if he'd said something funny." They all laughed, just to add their voices to the room, to get her through this. "He said, 'You've taken care of your brother all your life, and I want you to know I've got it from here.' And he did. He didn't know what he was signing on for, but he was with Nico to the absolute end. And now he's taking care of him again." She barely got it out. A girlfriend walked her down from the lectern, rubbing her back. One of Terence's teaching colleagues read a poem Yale couldn't focus on. The minister led everyone in a meditation. Asher, who was a classically trained baritone, sang the Pie Jesu from Weber's New Requiem, a song Yale had only heard a soprano recording of, but that worked just as well for Asher. For the cello, Yale had always imagined living in Asher's throat. Yale, no more Catholic than Asher was, reveled now in the sound of Latin, those pure liturgical vowels, the crunch of Q's and C's. The song wasn't just a lamentation. It was a ringing out, Yale was a wet washcloth, and someone was squeezing everything out of him over a sink. He didn't look at Charlie. He could hear him breathing, hear him blowing his nose. At Nico's vigil, they'd held hands. He did look back at the rows behind them. 7 teenagers sat together, without parents. Yale imagined they were students who'd somehow gotten word. Behind them sat Teddy and Richard. Teddy drummed his left hand on the chair back. Some of Terrence's family sat in the rear. Or at least he assumed they were family. A tall young man who looked remarkably like Terrence. 3 young black women. No one who looked the right age to be Terrence's parents. But 1 woman old enough to be his grandmother. When it was over, Yale and Charlie walked out together, and they each hugged Fiona. Yale spotted Julian across the church lobby. He hadn't seen him in the sanctuary, but here he was now by the coat rack, eyes wide and glassy. He'd lost weight. Yale didn't imagine it was the virus. The odds of Julian getting sick precisely when he learned he had the thing were low. He realized Charlie was staring too. And for an instant, Yale and Charlie were aligned again, communicating telepathically. Yale whispered to Charlie, "Did you tell him?" "No." And then they were apart once more, thinking completely different things. And Yale knew Charlie was remembering whatever he'd done with Julian. Memories Yale was forever, mercifully, locked out of. Yale took off down the hall to the youth room for his box. But when he'd picked it up and turned around, Charlie was there in the doorway, just looking at him. Yale said, "For whatever it's worth, I'm sorry you're sick. But beyond that, I have very little sympathy for you right now." The lights were off in the room. Street lights through the windows, but that was all. Charlie said, "I think I figured out why I did it." "Oh, do tell." Yale held the box in front of him, a barrier. "This might not make sense, but I think I did it because I was tired of being scared."
"You were terrified of a disease, so you went out and got it?"
"No, no.
I was scared of you leaving me, of you cheating on me with someone younger and better looking and smarter. I know it's fucked up, but somewhere in my mind it was like, if I did the worst thing I could think of, then every time I saw you flirt with someone else, I'd almost hope you would go for it, so it would even the score."
"You thought this all through?"
"Not at the time, no. I was Blotto, Yale. And Julian had these poppers he'd stolen from Rich's house."
"Poppers last all of 10 seconds.
That's not what I meant. I mean what we did in bed. I wouldn't have..."
"Jesus, Charlie.
I wouldn't have let him.
I think your little self-analysis is way off. I think you were absolutely trying to get sick."
Yale was yelling, and he didn't care.
"Why is the question, but that's for you to figure out. Maybe you hate yourself. Maybe you hate me. Maybe you want the attention. There's no good reason, is there? When you know the risks, you're not naive. You're the fucking condom czar of Chicago."
Charlie was shaking his head. Charlie never seemed to cry actual tears, but his eyes would turn pink and puffy. He hadn't come far into the room, was standing near the doorway as if he might run out. He said,
"We used a rubber. We did. We were in Nico's apartment at first, when things, you know. And we were in the bathroom, and it was dark. And before we left, I asked Julian if he had a rubber, and he said, 'I bet there's one here somewhere.' And he groped around the medicine cabinet, and he put a couple in his pocket. And then we went back to his place. But later, before I left, I saw the wrapper, and it was lambskin."
"Holy fuck, Charlie. It was probably old, too."
"Probably.
I don't even believe you.
Really. You used a rubber, but it was dark, and oops, it was lambskin?" Why would Nico even have lambskin? For what? To prevent pregnancy? You can come up with a better story. How many times did he fuck you, really? I was willing to believe you. I was almost ready to believe you, and you come up with lambskin. It was one time. Just one great post-funeral fuck. Why not make it two? He's out there right now. Have at it. Yale. Teddy fucks half the city and gets nothing, but the one time you mess up, with a rubber, you magically get sick. You should go on the talk show circuit. You should go into high schools and give them the scare talk. Tell the Republicans. They'll love you. Yale, stop. Charlie was shouting now, too. You know it doesn't work like that. You know it's random. Are you aware that you haven't apologized? Has that crossed your mind? You're making excuses and stories about lambskin. You're coming up with theories about your motivation, and you haven't once asked if I'm okay. You have not once acknowledged that you've blown up my entire life. Charlie opened his mouth, but Yale kept going. You spend 5 years playing up this monogamy thing, putting a fucking leash on me, and meanwhile, you're doing whatever the hell you want. You know what? It's all greed. Our relationship was about you. And whatever the hell you did, that was about you. And your refusal to consider anything but your own feelings right now, that's definitely about you. Charlie put his hands on his head. He said, that might be true. But I cannot begin to deal with your emotional needs right now. My mother is draining me enough. Yale pushed past him with the box, rammed the corner into Charlie's chest. He said, at least you have her. I have no one. He went down the hall and passed a woman he didn't know, and then past Teddy and Asher, who were close enough that they'd probably heard the shouting. Back at Cecily's place, all the lights were off. She'd given Yale a key, and he opened the door quietly, the box balanced on his hip. A latchkey kid, like Kurt. He changed in the apartment's only bathroom. Cecily's makeup and face creams and curling iron littered one side of the sink. The other held just Kurt's red toothbrush and an egg timer. Yale took his shirt off and checked his chest, his back, the smooth, pale skin on the insides of his upper arms. Not that there weren't 1,000 other ways the virus could manifest. Not that it wouldn't wait, invisible, for years. When Terrence was first diagnosed, he'd said, it's like putting a quarter in the toy machine at the grocery store. You know the possibilities, but you have no idea what you'll get. Like, will it be pneumonia, or Kaposi's, or herpes, or what? He mimed opening one of the plastic balls. Oh, look, toxoplasmosis. How many times had he and Charlie had sex between Nico's memorial and New Year's? Only slightly less often than usual. Maybe 10 times. Maybe Charlie had put his faith in that lambskin, if it was even real. Or in Julian not being sick. Julian had looked so healthy. Still, Charlie could have made excuses. Could have said his back was out. He could have gotten tested. Although maybe he'd been waiting for the 3-month mark, the same way Yale was now. But then when he heard about Julian, he went ahead and did it. And lo and behold, early antibodies. Yale put his t-shirt on, and when he went back out, Cecily was in the kitchen, pulling a tea bag out of her mug. She wore a robe and slippers, and she looked, Yale had learned this his first night there, like an entirely different person without makeup. She asked how he was feeling, and then she said, I'm afraid there's a problem. Oh. It's my ex. I guess, you know, the other night I mentioned my friend Andrew in front of Kurt. Kurt's so smart, and he notices more than I think. He misunderstood, though, and he thought you were sick. He doesn't mind. He knows Andrew and everything, and he told your ex I have AIDS. I explained that you didn't. Basically, I told the truth. I said you'd been exposed to the virus. But Bruce freaked out. And he's saying he can't believe you're staying with us, eating food with us. It's ridiculous, but this is what he's like.
It wouldn't help for me to talk to him, would it?
The thing is, we haven't always agreed on custody details, and he thinks he could use this somehow in court.
She bit her top lip with her bottom teeth. He felt suddenly exhausted.
Got it. Honestly, he probably could. If he got the right judge.
Yale looked down at his sweatpants, his bare feet. He said,
If I stayed one more night, do you think that would be okay?
He felt terrible asking. He'd compromised Cecily's career, and now he was upsetting her family. This woman barely had it together, and Yale was stomping across her life.
Of course, but then...
I'll clear out in the morning.
I'm sorry, Yale. And Kurt feels terrible. He knows he messed up. What's funny is Kurt didn't even mind. He just thinks it's interesting. He's been hearing about it on the news.
He didn't mess up. Can you let him know that?
This was the last thing you needed.
Yale said, honestly. It means more that you would take me in than that someone wouldn't want me here.
Kurt's worried about you. I told him you aren't sick, but he's worried everyone's going to be mean to you.
Well, I might get sick. She nodded, serious.
I feel so strongly that you're going to be okay.
Are you okay? He said. Your job? She hesitated.
As long as those paintings are real, I'm probably fine.
Her face was pinched, and he wasn't convinced she was giving him the whole story.
Even if they're not, it's just a job, Yale. This has reminded me of that, you know? There are more serious things.
In the morning, Yale was dressed and shaved and out the door with his stuff before Kurt and Cecily's alarms went off. 2015. She didn't have Arnaud's permission to do this, but what the hell did she care about Arnaud? Arnaud wanted to stretch things out. Arnaud was getting paid. Plus, when Jake showed up at Richard's flat late the next afternoon, she wanted to hustle him out of there. If he was there to bother Richard, he needed to leave. And if he was there to bother her, he could do it elsewhere. So before Serge could invite him to sit down, get him a drink, Fiona grabbed his arm and said,
I need your help with something,
and dragged him outside.
I know where he lives now, she said. The guy, the one who roped her into the cult. We're going back there.
We?
You're bigger than me. You're not as big as him, I should warn you, but he's not an athlete or anything.
Oh, great. But he followed, got in the cab. She said,
So you're really not an alcoholic?
I don't know. I've taken some of those online tests. Here's what it is. In America, I'm considered a heavy drinker. In France, I'm completely normal. She laughed, felt her pocket to make sure she hadn't left her phone at Richard's. If I dropped you into the 80s, into my group of friends, you'd be a monk.
Lots of parties?
We all had drinking problems. Every single one of us. Except some of the ones with drug problems.
And you survived, he said.
You're still here.
God, she hated him right then.
She said, Listen, when we get there, don't talk. You'll be scarier if you're silent.
Sure, he said.
I'm the muscle. She brushed his hand away before it even made contact with her knee. Fiona hoped, as they knocked, as her stomach did painful gymnastics, that the wife would answer, that she'd invite them in, and Kurt would return from work to find them all on the couch, drinking tea. But it was Kurt who answered, stared blankly. He looked more at Jake than at Fiona, until finally, he turned to her, and his eyes went wide. His hand went to his ponytail.
Oh, he said. Hey, I... Oh, wow.
Hey, Fiona. Fiona said, We're coming in. And she ducked under his arm and into an apartment that, with grocery bags on the counter and an open laptop on the couch, looked significantly fuller and warmer than it had yesterday. Fiona had spent an inordinate amount of her adult life engaged in two different ongoing fantasies. One, especially lately, was the exercise in which she'd walk through Chicago and try to bring it back as it was in 1984, 1985. She'd start by picturing brown cars on the street. Brown cars parked nose to tail, mufflers falling off. Instead of the Gap, the Woolworths with the lunch counter. Wax Trax Records, where the oral surgeon was now. And if she could see all that, then she could see her boys on the sidewalks in bomber jackets, calling after each other, running to cross before the light changed. She could see Nico in the distance, walking toward her. The other fantasy was the one where Nico walked beside her everywhere, wondering what the hell things were. He was Rip Van Winkle, and it was her job to explain the modern world. She'd done it at O'Hare on her way here. Focused as she was on Claire, on getting to Paris, she'd suddenly had Nico beside her on the moving walkway as it rolled past a sign advertising a firewall for your cloud. How could she even begin to explain why a cloud needed a wall of fire? And once he was in her head, he was following her all around the terminal, ordering food with her off the iPad at the pizza counter, jumping at the auto-flush toilet, reading the scroll at the bottom of CNN, and asking what bitcoins were. He asked why everyone was staring at calculators. You're living in the future, he whispered. Thief, this is the future. And when she saw something he'd fully understand, a baby crying for a dropped pacifier, a McDonald's, the whole wall, was it still possible, of payphones, she felt the world had been set right. And there were times, too, when she simply narrated for herself what was happening around her. Things that sounded as if they could have come from another era. Right now, for instance, she told herself she was sitting here with Kurt Pierce, that she and Kurt Pierce were having a conversation, that Richard was off at his studio, and she needed to give Cecily a call later, a description that would have made perfect sense in 1988. Except Kurt would be an adolescent, not this enormous man sitting opposite her, his legs reaching halfway across the floor. Jake wouldn't have been standing against the wall, arms folded across his chest in an attempt to look like a bodyguard. Kurt seemed sober, lucid. He spoke quietly, his voice impossibly deep.
I don't know how much I can tell you. I don't know if you're going to try something.
Try something? Fiona said, and then stopped herself. She shouldn't get emotional.
I always thought she was way too harsh on you. You did the best you could. And you're making an effort. I get it.
He seemed so young. This whole time, she'd hated him for being closer to her own age than to Claire's. And he was just a kid. A hippie doofus. He said,
Look, I wish it had worked out differently. I messed up pretty bad for a while. But everyone's fine. We're all doing okay. Hey, what happened to your hand?
Are they here in Paris?
I can tell you everyone's safe and healthy. But beyond that, it's not my place to tell you stuff. I'm lucky to be back in their lives. I'm lucky Claire allows that.
It was all Fiona hoped for herself. To be allowed back in. She hadn't messed up as badly as Kurt. She hadn't been arrested, at least. But maybe she'd messed up for longer. And maybe it was harder to forgive your mother than a man. She'd always figured that her own failings would make more and more sense to Claire as she grew up. That an adult would understand an affair. Such a garden variety mistake. In a way a child couldn't have. Shouldn't Claire know the messiness of the human heart by now?
She had too many questions for Kurt, and no good starting point. And she couldn't give away that she'd spied on him. Been in this apartment yesterday. She said, "I understand you're married." He looked back and forth between Fiona and Jake, and then he said, "Yeah, she's a good match. It's healthy." "Well, I'm happy for you. I've always wanted the best for you, and I just wish..." She wouldn't be able to express how much fondness she'd always felt for him, or at least for his memory, at the same time that she loathed him with all her being for taking her daughter away. She said, "You're clear of the group, right? The Hosanna people?" Kurt laughed. "You can call them a cult. That's what they are. Yeah, I was happy to put an ocean between us." "So you soured on them?"
"Hey, can I get you a beer?"
Fiona shook her head.
"Can I get you a beer?"
he said to Jake. And thank God Jake said no. He wouldn't have looked nearly as effective with a bottle in his hand. Kurt got up and fetched himself one, sat back down.
"She soured. I was never that big on them, but I was in love."
"How does being in love mean you have to join a cult?"
"It was what she wanted. She, at the beginning, she cared more about them than about me. That was obvious. If I made her choose, I knew who she'd choose. And it wasn't me."
Fiona glanced at Jake, but he was still just standing there. This made no sense. "You were the one who lived in Boulder," Fiona said. "You were the one who... you found the cult."
Nope. She met this guy in the kitchen of the restaurant where she was working. And at least I knew it wasn't romantic, because he had this terrible skin and he was sort of emaciated. But he invited her out to a party at the compound, and she brought me along. I thought the whole thing was ridiculous. Tambourines and drums, right? There's this girl named Fish, I swear to God, who just latches on to Claire and talks to her all night. They give me this tea that's laced with something. They weren't into drinking, but man, would they lace your tea. And we end up crashing on the floor. It seemed like a laid-back place, until they got their claws in. And Claire wanted to go back night after night. She was about to lose her apartment at the end of the month, and I'd offered to let her move in with me, but then Fish told her there was a room we could both stay in. It really, I mean, they got to me, too, after a while. Don't get me wrong, they have a way of doing that. But Claire's the one who pulled me down the rabbit hole. I'm not just trying to make myself look good here. Fiona found that she believed Kurt, but still she wanted to scream that he was lying, that her daughter would never fall for something like that, because the people who got suckered by cults were the ones who'd never really had a family to begin with, the ones who, under other circumstances, might have joined a gang. Or at least that was the thing you told yourself to explain why bad stuff happened to someone else's kid. But your kid would be okay. But a battered woman she could understand. A woman so under the sway of a domineering man that she had no choice but to go along with it. Although she'd never wished that on Claire. Wasn't it the story that let Fiona herself off the hook? Fiona said, "And you gave them all your savings?" "I didn't really have savings. And actually, they helped me close out my credit cards. I only owed a couple $1,000s, but they paid it all off so I could shut them down. Which, at the time, I was like, I'll take it."
The bill for Claire's MasterCard had continued to show up in Fiona's inbox. And she kept paying the annual fee this whole time, hoping sooner or later Claire would charge something, giving a clue where she was. She never had. Fiona was ready to ask it now. Why did they pick her? How did they know it would work? Because you could try that on 100 people and 99 would walk away. Kurt shrugged.
I guess they have practice. Listen, if we get all psychological about it, she was already drawn to an older man, right? She was looking for parent figures.
Fiona had wanted him to say it out loud, so she could hate him. she said. Damien was a big part of her life. Look, you were a child of divorce, too, and back when it was less common. It doesn't mean you walk around damaged.
Kurt stood.
He stretched and put his palm flat on the ceiling. He said,
I can't judge. But one of the first things she ever told me, in Boulder, was that the day she was born was the worst day of your life.
She told me you said that to her.
That's not true. Was it possible that this was the stone in Claire's shoe? That it wasn't about Fiona's affair, the divorce at all? Her hand was throbbing, taking all the ache that should have been in her head, her gut.
She grew up knowing she'd ruined your life, Kurt said. What do you think that does to a person?
Fiona stood too, and Jake took a step into the room, like he was getting ready to dive between them. First of all, I never said that to her. It was something Damien told her in the middle of the divorce to poison her against me. Second, yes, that was one of the worst days of my life. Although Lord knows I've had lots of them. But it had nothing to do with Claire. This isn't some huge secret. It was a terrible day. A shit show. That doesn't mean I didn't want her. And it didn't change the way I raised her.
Hey, I'm not saying. I remember that day, too. I was...
You don't think that's more than a little fucked up? That you remember the day your girlfriend was born?
She's not my girlfriend.
He held his hands up, an unattackable Buddha.
I'm trying to help you out here. You want to make things right with her? This is the swamp you have to wade through, okay? Claire is... She's not a happy person. I don't think she'd ever have been happy, no matter what you did. It's like bad astrology or something. She's just a fundamentally angry human. You weren't a bad mother.
But why did it hurt so much if it wasn't true?
Listen, I need to ask you to get out of here before my wife gets home. She's not a fan of the Claire drama.
Does she know Claire? Fiona said.
Kurt opened his mouth but then stopped. He'd caught her trick.
She said, Can you at least pass a message on?
He shook his head slowly. She had fully expected him to say yes.
I'm barely in her good graces. I bring this to her, and maybe she takes it out on me. If she finds out I talk to you, let you in, Jake said. What about an email address?
Fiona didn't mind him talking. It was time to team up. Kurt went to the door, opened it for them, though Fiona didn't move.
Here's what I can give you. Everyone's okay. Everyone's safe. You want to leave me your number? I can promise I'd call you if anything bad ever happened.
You'll tell me if she dies? How thoughtful.
That's not what I...
Look, what about the little girl? Is she yours?
Kurt put an enormous hand not on Fiona's shoulder but on Jake's and steered him effortlessly through the doorway, like guiding a toy boat. Fiona quickly fished a pen and her old boarding pass from her purse, wrote her number down. She said, before she walked out the door,
You're a father. Think about what this feels like. Use your imagination. I know you used to have one.
Out on the street, Jake wrapped Fiona in a hug, pressed his beard and lips to her forehead. He said,
I can tell you're a good mom.
Fiona worried he would ask where she was going. Ask if he could tag along, but she told him she needed to be alone. She was well practiced at shaking men, and she got in a cab and asked the driver to take her to Montparnasse. She didn't want to go back to Richards, she knew that much, even though her hand felt like it was touching a live wire, and she'd forgotten to bring the painkillers.
Promise me you'll practice self-care, her shrink had said to her before she left.
And she didn't imagine Elena had meant fucking vagrant former pilots. She could have a nice dinner. That was one thing she could do. She wound up at La Rotonde,
the place Aunt Nora used to talk about. The place, if Fiona remembered right, where Renko Novak lost his mind. Or was it Modigliani? In any case, she sat inside where it was warm, and she ordered soup à l'oignon gratiné, and wished she weren't surrounded by so many English speakers. There were no scruffy, drunk artists, no absinthe-drinking models, no great expat poets. Well, how would she know? Maybe that table in the corner was full of them. She'd asked Nora once if she'd ever met Hemingway, and Nora had said,
"If I did, he didn't make an impression."
But she imagined that in the intervening decades, the avant-garde had changed its meet-up spot. If this was really where Renko Novak had lost it, it seemed an odd place. Everything was warm and red and magical, and the soup was so good. Well, if you were going to be miserable, you could be miserable anywhere. She'd known that for years. The way one person could starve to death at the banquet, the way you could sob through the funniest movie. The waiter asked if she would like dessert. She ordered another soup instead, exactly the same as the first. 1986. After the gallery closed, Yale brushed his teeth in the bathroom. He shaved again so he'd look okay in the morning, and he changed his shirt. He left his things under his desk. Evanston was not a town where places stayed open all night, and he thought he'd have a better chance in the city, so he went back down on the L. His plan was to stay pretty south on Clark, where Charlie wasn't as likely to be. He started down at Inner Circle, which was dead, and then he headed up toward Cheeks to see if the cute, bald bartender was working. He was a block away when he saw, in front of him on the sidewalk, the back of Bill Lindsay, his loping gait. Yale froze and figured he'd backtrack, but then Bill looked over his shoulder and stopped and called to Yale, gave a giant wave that Yale couldn't pretend not to have seen. When Yale caught up, Bill said, "You live near here, yes? It's not an area I know too well." "A bit north of here." "Well, this is serendipity. I have something in my car that I forgot to bring to the office today." "You're going to be thrilled." And so Yale found himself following Bill to his Buick, the same car they'd all ridden triumphantly back from Wisconsin in. Bill was parked right outside Cheeks. He didn't seem embarrassed at all, except that he was talking faster than usual. "Look," Bill said, and thrust an enormous book at him. Yale rested it on the car's hood. "Bassin, Catalogue raisonné. Peinture, aquarelle, pastel, dessin. The second volume." Bill said, "Page 60. Tell me what you see." "Oh." A woman in a chair. Blonde waves parted far to one side. A nightgown falling off her shoulders, pooling in her lap. The pose was exactly the same as in Nora's supposed Passin study. The face was the same. The only difference was that here she wore clothes. Yale said, "That's great news." He felt like laughing, that his luck should be so good only at work. "I can ask her about it," Yale said. "I can take this up there with me." "What I want you to do, before you get all her stories, and I know that's what she wants, is to see if she can remember what paintings might have been done from the sketches. Because this one, for instance, Yale, this is in the Musée d'Orsay. Maybe they'll have interest in the sketch, you know? Display it beside the original. Not to sell," he said, seeing Yale's face, "but a loan or exchange. I can send the catalogs with you to Wisconsin. Of course, there's no Ebuterne catalog, or Sergei What's-His-Face, and no Renko Novak catalog, but we're going to load your trunk with books." "And you're sure you don't want to come?" "I have so much to do for the Polaroids." The Polaroid show didn't open till August, but Bill was dealing with loaned Ansel Adams and Walker Evans pieces, and every time he talked about the exhibit, he wound up flapping his hands in frustration. I want you back up there very soon. You and Roman. He's a fine specimen, no? Yale had no idea how to respond. He seems like a quick study, he said. As he got in his car, Bill winked. Yale sank onto a bar stool in the darkest corner of Cheeks and pried his feet loose from the stickiness of the floor and ordered a Manhattan. It was a safe place to spend time, and they wouldn't close till 4, and he kept seeing faces he vaguely knew. The receptionist from the gay-friendly dentist on Broadway, Katsu Tatami's ex, the tall Canadian Nico had once been obsessed with. He had a long purple lesion on his left cheekbone. A former staffer of Charlie's came up to say hi, and one of Julian's theater friends, the one who'd played Fortinbras in Hamlet. The place was oddly full for a Monday. Some kind of bat signal had been sent up, apparently. The cute bartender wasn't there, but the one on duty had a generous pour. A dusky guy in a ripped t-shirt dropped a matchbook in Yale's lap, and when Yale opened it, he found a phone number on the flap. It occurred to Yale that he was essentially single now, that he could go home with someone, take advantage of a warm bed and a shower, a distraction. The problem was he wasn't sure he remembered how to flirt. It had been too long. That, and the fact that all he could think about were germs and bodily fluids. The whole bar looked to him like a petri dish. Despite the number of people, everyone seemed subdued, just kind of nodding their heads to the Bronski bead and standing in little groups. Maybe because it was so cold out that the frost blasted in every time the door opened. The whole cruise with your shirt off thing worked a hell of a lot better in L.A. Someone squeezed the back of his neck, and he looked up to see Richard, the silver waves of his hair catching the bar lights. He got close to Yale's ear, spoke loudly. "This is a rare sighting. Yale down here in the deep south, slumming with the likes of me." "I just needed somewhere to go." Richard nodded like he understood. He said, "Museums should stay open all night, for this very reason. You could wander around the Field Museum. No one would dare assault you in front of a sarcophagus." "We should move all the museums to Boys Town." Richard laughed. "If we move the museums to Boys Town, they just turn into bars. That's why I don't move there myself."
"You'd turn into a bar?"
"No, a raging alcoholic." He told Richard about running into Bill Lindsay outside. Richard said, "Start watching for him, and I bet you'll see him crouching in the corner every time you're out." He was surveying the room. "I want to shoot some video in here," he said. "It's so viscerally sleazy." Yale said, "Are you kidding? You'd be banned for life."
"Mr. Technicality."
"That's my job. To suck the soul out of art." Richard said, "You either need more booze or less. Shall we get you more?" The door opened again, and more icy wind flooded the room. A new cluster pushed in, loud, already drunk. Julian was in the midst of them. Of course he was. He hoped Julian wouldn't see him, but Richard was waving him over. Richard had always had a thing for Julian, was always asking him to pose, and now Julian was heading straight toward them. He put both arms around Richard's neck and hung there like a huge, drunk necklace. He wore a hat and a sweater, but no coat. He slurred what sounded like, "Richard, I can live in your house." It might have been something else. He sounded like an old man who'd forgotten his dentures. Richard said, "Julian, what are you on?" Julian fell between Richard and Yale, caught himself on the bar.
"It's kid stuff. We were at Paradise. Let's go back to Paradise. I didn't want to leave." "Oh, Yale."
He put out a hand and touched Yale's chin.
"Yale, I had to tell you something."
No, you don't. Yeah, wanted to hate him, but he couldn't.